his reputation as a hard-nosed fixer, as Roy Cohn 2.0, his new pit bull. "If somebody does something Mr. Trump doesn't like, I do everything in my power to resolve it to Mr. Trump's benefit," he told ABC News in 2011. "If you do something wrong, I'm going to come at you, grab you by the neck, and I'm not going to let you go until I'm finished." Fittingly, perhaps, on Twitter, his hashtag would become hashtag Secretary of Loyalty. And so, all the strands had started to come together. There was a booming real estate market. There was Vladimir Putin's festering bitterness about his country's humiliating Cold War defeat. There were Putin's dreams of reviving Russia's imperial glory. There was the newly globalized post-Cold War version of the Russian mafia, still very much a state actor in league with Russian intelligence. There were untold billions of dollars in flight capital in anonymous shell companies in Cyprus, the Channel Islands, Panama, and other havens for dark money. There were sumptuous chateaus, villas, dachas, and estates, one bigger than the next. Gigantic yachts, private jets, and all the rest, all part of a new culture of unimaginable greed. And finally, there was Donald Trump, emerging from a decade of litigation, multiple bankruptcies, and $4 billion in debt, to rise from the near dead with the help of Bayrock and its alleged ties to Russian intelligence and the Russian mafia. "They saved his bacon," said Kenneth McCallion, a former federal prosecutor who filed suit against Mogilevich, Paul Manafort, Ukrainian oligarch Dmitry Firtash, and others on behalf of former Ukrainian Prime Minister Yulia Tymoshenko. But Trump's rescue by the Russians was not cost-free. By working with Bayrock, McCallion says, Trump may well have been performing gigantic favors for Vladimir Putin without even knowing it. Indeed, in 2016, Trump's political adversaries commissioned Christopher Steele, a former MI6 agent, to dig up opposition research on Trump. And among the most astonishing allegations in the infamous 35-page Steele dossier, which alleges Trump has been severely compromised by Russia, is that Trump unknowingly regularly supplied intelligence to Vladimir Putin. On the face of it, Steele's allegation seems absurd to anyone familiar with Trump's insistent tweeting, impulsive outbursts, and scores of outrageous indiscretions. Who could possibly believe he had the discipline necessary to carry out such a daring intelligence operation? On the other hand, Steele's dossier specifically said the intelligence in question was about the activities of business oligarchs and their families' activities and assets in the U.S., with which Putin and the Kremlin seemed preoccupied. That kind of intel was crucial to Putin because his relationship with the oligarchs often seesawed back and forth. Putin oversaw them with an iron fist, and when they fell out of favor, they either towed the line or ended up being purged, media executives Vladimir Gusinsky and Boris Berezovsky, being jailed, Yukos Oil's Mikhail Khodorkovsky, and or dying under mysterious circumstances, Berezovsky. Thanks to Bayrock, McCallion suggests the future president was indirectly providing Putin with a regular flow of intelligence on what the oligarchs were doing with their money in the U.S. "I believe that Christopher Steele was right," says McCallion. "Initially, Trump wasn't that important to Putin, but now that Trump was getting investments from the Russians, Putin could keep track of where their money went because Bayrock kept a ledger that Moscow likely had access to. It was not just about buying condos, which was the tail wagging the dog. It was direct capital investment into various Trump projects." In other words, for example, if capital came into Bayrock from Iceland's FL Group, as it did for Trump Soho, Putin would likely know. "Putin didn't stop the expatriation of billions of dollars because he benefited from it," said McCallion. "But it was a serious problem for the Russian economy. Billions of dollars were going out, and he really wanted to keep track of it for a variety of reasons, to see what the financial strength was of the oligarchs. If the Sapir organization, or the trio behind the Eurasian Natural Resources Corporation, Mashkevich, Chodiev, and Ibrahimov, or Lev Leviev invested a few hundred million or so, Vladimir Putin would know. He would know if Felix Sater was trying to strike a deal with Mirax's Sergei Polonsky. He would know about money that was being laundered through the purchase of condos in Trump Soho and other developments. He would know about Tevfik Arif's various adventures. And through Chabad, he would have access to even more information about his oligarchs. Nor is McCallion the only one who believes Steele might be right about Trump's inadvertent funneling of intelligence to Putin. If you read the Steele dossier about Trump providing information on Russian money and oligarchs, says John Cipher, maybe that is Felix Sater finding out where Russian money is coming in from and relaying it back to Russia. Maybe he is the go-between. I don't know. Of course, Sater has repeatedly denied any such allegations. Regardless, Cipher and other undercover CIA operatives in Moscow were told that the Russian mafia was simply not in their purview. In fact, when you arrived in Moscow, agents were given operational directives that explicitly told them to stay away from them, Cipher said. To Trump's people, it was like a moth to a flame. That left the FBI as the most powerful remaining bulwark against the Russian mafia. But the FBI was infatuated with Felix Sater, raving about his contributions to national security, as Bayrock allegedly laundered huge sums of Russian money. Many questions about the FBI's interaction with Sater remain unanswered, but one gauge of its relationship to the Russian mafia can be seen in the trajectory of former FBI Director William Sessions. Once one of the premier law enforcement officers in the nation, in 1997, Sessions had gone to Moscow to address the issue of the Russian mafia. "I believe we can beat organized crime," he told the assembled crowd. But 10 years later, back in private practice, Sessions had moved in another direction. Just as Bob Dole and Jack Abramoff and Tom DeLay and Barbara Griffith and Rogers had jumped on the Russian gravy train, William Sessions decided to take on a Russian client. In this case, the client had been charged with racketeering and was trying to negotiate a deal with the U.S. Department of Justice, and was so powerful that he not only had made the FBI's 10 most wanted list, but had now gotten a former FBI director, William Sessions, to represent him. Sessions's client, of course, was Semyon Mogilevich. In the end, Mogilevich did not get the plea deal he wanted. But the mere fact that the former head of the FBI had a client who, according to the U.S. Department of Justice, represented an enormous national security threat provides a sense of how deeply the Russian mafia had penetrated America's defenses. What would be worse, of course, was if the Russian mafia somehow managed to go even further and breach the White House, all of which seemed extraordinarily far-fetched. Even though Trump had expressed his presidential ambitions by this time, no one took him terribly seriously. As for what Trump thought when he took stock of Putin's presidency in Russia, that was open to speculation, but increasingly, it looked as if he liked what he saw. He saw a guy who, A, can be president for life, basically, and B, is worth about $200 billion, said Kenneth McCallion. So Trump had to be thinking, why not here? Chapter 15. Putin's Revenge. On April 25, 2005, in his annual address to the nation, Vladimir Putin called the demise of the Soviet Union the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the 20th century. More than a mere soundbite that romanticized the deceased communist state, Putin's pronouncement could be seen as his reassertion of the idea that Russia must fulfill its great imperial destiny, all of which portended renewed conflict, in one form or another, with the West. which should have surprised no one. Even before the Soviet Union took its last breath, Eastern Bloc satellites had started to abandon Russia. First, in 1990, what had formerly been East Germany reunited with the Federal Republic of Germany and became part of NATO. That included Dresden, Putin's old haunt. In 1999, three former communist countries, Hungary, the Czech Republic, and Poland, joined NATO. After that, Western officials repeatedly assured Russia that NATO would not expand to the east, but broke their pledge. By the time of Putin's speech in 2005, seven more Eastern Bloc countries, Bulgaria, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Romania, Slovakia, and Slovenia, had joined NATO. Albania, Croatia, and Montenegro followed. For Putin, however, the red line was Ukraine, a nation of more than 40 million people that is Russia's breadbasket, an essential trade partner, and Russia's biggest buffer with the West. Under no circumstances would Putin allow it to fall to the West. Yet Ukraine's Orange Revolution of 2004 had posed a grave threat to Putin's control. The protests had their genesis in a crisis that began in September 2000 when Georgian politician and journalist Georgi Gongadze, a prominent critic of President Leonid Kuchma's administration and its close ties to Putin, wrote a story, Everything About Oleksandr Volkov, published on the Ukrainska Pravda website, tying Volkov, a top Kuchma advisor, to the Russian mafia. A high-level oligarch himself, Volkov was one of several people close to Kuchma who had helped Dmitry Firtash get established in the Ukraine energy trade, allegedly with Mogilevich. In addition, Volkov had begun partnering with Boris Bierstein, Sergei Mikhailov, and Semyon Mogilevich as early as 1994, according to All Is Clouded by Desire, Global Banking, Money Laundering, and International Organized Crime by Alan A. Block and Constance A. Weaver. He was such a scary guy, the authors write, that hardly anyone in the Ukraine who wasn't a crook would utter his name. And now Gongadze was reporting that Volkov had foreign bank accounts with $15 million in them, $5 million of which allegedly came from Sibeko, the company Boris Bierstein ran with Alex Schneider, Alexander Mashkevich, and Patok Chodiev. But on September 16, 2000, after his expose of Volkov was published on Ukrainska Pravda, Gongadze disappeared. Shortly afterward, Deputy Interior Minister Mykola Zhiha announced that, among other theories, authorities thought Gongadze might have staged his own abduction. That turned out to be incorrect. 2 months later, his decapitated body was found about 70 miles outside Kiev. Gongadze's murder has never been solved, but there is reason to believe someone at the highest levels of the Ukrainian government orchestrated his assassination. One key piece of evidence comes from the clandestine tape recordings made by Mykola Melnichenko, a former bodyguard to President Kuchma, who secretly recorded 500 hours of conversations in Kuchma's office between 1999 and 2000. Among them is a conversation with Ukrainian Secret Service Chief Leonid Dekach. As reported by Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, in the Melnichenko tapes, President Kuchma says, I'm telling you, drive him, Gongadze, out. Throw him out. Give him to the Chechens, expletive. Have him become a hostage. Let them pay a ransom for him. To which another voice, believed to be that of Interior Minister Yuri Kravchenko, replies, We will think it through. We will do what is needed. I was told today that we are preparing a program for him. We are studying his movements, where he goes. We need to learn this, and then we will act. President Kuchma denied that any such surveillance of Gongadze took place, and maintained that the Melnichenko recordings made in the president's office are fakes. However, in 2001, a former FBI forensic expert at Bechtech, a private audio lab in Virginia, determined that the audio recordings regarding the surveillance of Gongadze were genuine. Later, in 2002, according to Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, the FBI came to the same conclusion when it examined a different segment of the recordings. Gongadze's murder was the first of dozens, many of which remain unsolved, in which journalists and others who were investigating Putin's kleptocratic tribute system were mysteriously killed. According to the Committee to Protect Journalists, no fewer than 70 journalists have been murdered in Russia and Ukraine between 1992 and 2018. These were the men and women who had been reporting on how Putin's system enriched his cronies, various oligarchs of his choosing, and mobsters. American journalists were not immune. On the night of July 9, 2004, Paul Klebnikov, the 41-year-old editor of Forbes Russia and the author of Godfather of the Kremlin, The Decline of Russia in the Age of Gangster Capitalism, left his Moscow office at about 10 p.m. He headed toward the subway when a car drove slowly by with someone firing 9 shots at him. Klebnikov died in the hospital. The murder, which is still unsolved, has been described as a contract killing that, according to the publisher of Forbes Russia, was definitely linked to Klebnikov's journalism. Some observers have suggested the attack was triggered by a recent Forbes story on the 100 richest people in Russia. Others suspected Boris Berezovsky of being behind the murder. Richard Behar, an investigative reporter with Forbes and a longtime friend and colleague of Klebnikov's, said the chief Russian investigator on the case told him, "I have testimony that Boris Berezovsky put a contract out on Klebnikov, from a person to whom Berezovsky spoke." But the case remained unsettled. Behar told Klebnikov's family that if Paul were alive today, he'd be able to solve his own murder. That was the irony and tragedy. If he was alive, he'd be breaking more ground on Trump Russia than any other individual reporter. I have absolutely no doubt of that. He was way, way out in front on so many things. Afterward, in 2005, with Klebnikov's murder still unsolved, Putin visited New York and invited Klebnikov's family to meet with him at the Waldorf Astoria, where he told them that journalists in Russia should be able to work without fear of violence. Without missing a beat, Behar said, Paul's widow, Musa, asked Putin if he would say that publicly. There was a long pause. Finally, Putin said he would take that under consideration. In 2005, Richard Behar launched Project Klebnikov to develop new information on the Klebnikov murder and to pursue Paul's investigative work. Not long afterward, he met with Anna Politkovskaya, a Russian journalist and human rights activist best known for her work with Novaya Gazeta, hoping she could gather together investigative reporters in Russia who would work hand-in-hand with Project Klebnikov. In her book, Putin's Russia, Life in a Failing Democracy, Politkovskaya accused Putin and the FSB of crushing civil liberties in order to establish a Soviet-style dictatorship. "The KGB respects only the strong," she wrote. "The weak it devours. We, of all people, ought to know that. We are hurtling back into a Soviet abyss," she added, "into an information vacuum that spells death from our own ignorance. All we have left is the Internet, where information is still freely available. For the rest, if you want to go on working as a journalist, it's total servility to Putin. Otherwise, it can be death, the bullet, poison, or trial. Whatever our special services, Putin's guard dogs, see fit." Journalists were not Putin's only targets. There were media censorship, a crackdown on the Internet, harassment of human rights activists, and more. By 2007, Putin had revived the old Soviet practice of locking up dissidents in mental hospitals. "We're returning to this Soviet scenario when psychiatric institutions are used as punitive instruments," Yuri Savyanko, president of the Independent Psychiatric Association of Russia, told the Chicago Tribune. I call this not even punitive psychiatry, but police psychiatry, when the main aim is to protect the state rather than to treat sick people. As Vladimir Kuczynski and Boris Berezovsky found out, even oligarchs were at risk. In August 2000, after Berezovsky's TV station, ORT, criticized Putin's handling of the Kursk submarine disaster, which killed more than 100 sailors, Putin was said to have told Berezovsky, "The show is over." Berezovsky fled to London, where he was granted refugee status in 2003, and became part of a London circle of Russian exiles who hoped to bring down Putin. He died under mysterious circumstances in 2013. As for Kuczynski, in 2001, Russian officials raided his Media Most and NTV and attempted to arrest him, but he escaped by fleeing to Israel. The state broadcaster, RTR, now Russia One, was already under Putin's control. Now he also controlled ORT, now First Channel, and NTV. Putin kept such tight control of the media that television coverage of him was almost celebratory. Imagine you have 24 TV channels and it is all Fox News, Vladimir Milov, a former deputy energy minister under Putin and now a critic, told The New Yorker. In February 2003, Mikhail Khodorkovsky, then believed to be the richest man in Russia with a fortune of $16 billion, appeared on a television show in which he argued with Putin about widespread corruption in the Kremlin. In October, he was arrested and charged with fraud, tax evasion, and other economic crimes. The message was clear. Even oligarchs had to play by Putin's rules. Meanwhile, one of Putin's fiercest critics was FSB officer Alexander Litvinenko, who had already confronted Putin with regard to the Berezovsky assassination plot. In October 2000, Litvinenko and his family fled Moscow and applied for asylum at the U.S. Embassy in Ankara, Turkey. His application was denied, but he was soon granted asylum in the U.K. and settled in London, reporting to MI6. In 2002, Litvinenko published The Gang from Lubyanka, alleging that Putin and the FSB had been in league with the Russian mafia, specifically the Tambov-Malyshev gang, dating back to when Putin was deputy mayor of St. Petersburg. The book also charged that Putin had direct financial ties to gang leader Vladimir Kumarin. Litvinenko, with co-author Yuri Felshtinsky, also published Blowing Up Russia, The Secret Plot to Bring Back KGB Terror, which brought renewed interest in the KGB apartment bombings of 1999 and other fabricated false flag cover operations, or as the Russians called them, active measures. Both books were banned in Russia, and in 2003, lawyer Mikhail Trepashkin said he had been told that everyone associated with Blowing Up Russia would be destroyed. In the meantime, Litvinenko became friends with Anna Politkovskaya, who visited him in London. His friend Alex Goldfarb, who was also a friend of Anna's, said the two were very close and that they shared a natural kinship as converts, Litvinenko having been a KGB officer, while Politkovskaya was the daughter of a well-placed Russian diplomat. Litvinenko had begun working with MI6 as a consultant on organized crime. At the same time, he reported his findings on Mogilevich's relationship with Putin to Mario Scaramella, an investigator affiliated with the Mitrokhin Commission, an Italian panel investigating the links between the Russian secret services and organized crime. Litvinenko and his wife, Marina, were only too happy to provide copious amounts of material, much of it about Semyon Mogilevich. Marina Litvinenko characterized Mogilevich as one of Russia's most notorious organized crime group leaders. It is said he is responsible for contract killings and smuggling weapons. For his part, Alexander Litvinenko described Mogilevich as a well-known criminal terrorist who was in a good relationship with Russian President Putin and most senior officials of the Russian Federation. He said that Mogilevich and Putin had a common cause, in Litvinenko's understanding, a criminal cause, and that he knew, beyond doubt, that Mogilevich is FSB's long-standing agent, and that all his actions, including the contacts with Al-Qaeda, are controlled by the FSB. For this very reason, the FSB is hiding Mogilevich from the FBI. Litvinenko was concerned enough about his testimony that when he returned to London on November 23, 2005, he made a short audio tape in broken English about Mogilevich and Putin. Mogilevich have good relationship with Putin since 1994 or 1993, he says on the tape, which was published 10 years later by the Telegraph of London. Semyon Mogilevich has contact with Al-Qaeda. Semyon Mogilevich sell weapons to Al-Qaeda. Before, I gave a lot of information about Mogilevich to Mario Scaramella. Litvinenko was also in touch with Oleg Kalugin, the ex-KGB general who had been in the U.S. since 1995. Kalugin felt the real reason Litvinenko was getting under Putin's skin was because he had come forward with outrageous accusations about Putin and charged that the Russian leader was a pedophile. Kalugin warned Litvinenko to keep his mouth shut. I told him, don't say that, you'll be in trouble. Putin could not tolerate that, Kalugin told me. Nonetheless, in July 2006, Litvinenko submitted a highly provocative article to the Chechen Press website, in which he referred to a video on the internet that showed Putin kissing the stomach of a young boy, aged 4 or 5. In the video, Putin's embrace of the young boy may be nothing more than harmless horsing around, but Litvinenko wrote, "Nobody can understand why the Russian president did such a strange thing as kissing the stomach of an unfamiliar small boy." Then Litvinenko explained the unusual gesture by saying that when Putin was given a very junior position in the KGB, it was because his bosses learned that Putin was a pedophile. The institute officials feared to report this to their own superiors, which would cause an unpleasant investigation. When Putin became FSB director, Litvinenko wrote, he found and destroyed videos which showed him making sex with some underage boys. At the same time, as if he were not courting enough danger, Litvinenko remained friends with Anna Politkovskaya and collaborated with her on a project exposing the FSB. Deeply concerned about the risks she faced investigating corruption, he suggested she take various precautions for her personal security and urged her to take advantage of her American citizenship and go write her articles in America. But she stayed in Russia. In New York, Richard Behar had a box on his desk in which he kept sundry memorabilia, including a business card on which Anna had written her email address. When they had met in New York, he told her that Project Klebnikov hoped to find investigative reporters in Russia who would help solve Paul's murder. She warned Behar she could probably count on one hand the number of Russian investigative reporters who aren't corrupt. But she had vowed to help anyway. Then, on October 7, 2006, Anna was shot dead in the elevator of her apartment complex in central Moscow. It happened to be Vladimir Putin's birthday. In London, Marina Litvinenko gave Sasha the news and later said, "He was just broken down because for him it was absolutely devastating news. He also worried that he could be next." On October 19th, Sasha went to a meeting at the Frontline Club in London, a restaurant gathering place for journalists, photographers, and other like-minded people, at which he made a short speech publicly accusing Putin of being responsible for Anna Politkovskaya's murder. Even after Anna's murder, however, Litvinenko didn't seem to take the threat to his own well-being too seriously. She had been in Russia, after all, but he had safely defected to the West. He took enormous pride in his newly won citizenship and seemed to regard it as an extra layer of protective covering. "Now they won't dare to touch me," he told a friend. "No one would try to kill a British citizen." And if something did happen, he wrote in a statement to British officials, at least he would be a proud British citizen. "Possibly I may die," he wrote, "but I will die as a free person, and my son and my wife are free people. And Britain is a great country." On November 1st, 2006, Litvinenko had lunch with Mario Scaramella at a Japanese restaurant, and Scaramella warned Litvinenko that he had received intelligence about a Russian plot to kill those involved with the Mitrokhin Commission. Later that day, after he and Scaramella finished, Litvinenko had tea at the Pine Bar in the Millennium Hotel in Mayfair at about 4 p.m., with Andrei Lugovoy and Dmitry Kovtun, two former KGB officers who had gone into private security. According to the Litvinenko Inquiry, an official report issued by the House of Commons about the death of Alexander Litvinenko, the forensic and other evidence strongly indicates that it was during this meeting that Mr. Litvinenko drank green tea poisoned with radioactive polonium. According to Norman Dombey, a British physics and astronomy emeritus professor at the University of Sussex, the radioactive isotope in Litvinenko's tea was made at the Avangard facility in Saraf, Russia. One of the isotope-producing reactors at the Mayak facility in Azhursk, Russia, was used for the initial irradiation of bismuth, said Dombey. In my opinion, the Russian state or its agents were responsible for the poisoning. From his hospital deathbed, Litvinenko told British authorities investigating his poisoning, "I have no doubt whatsoever that this was done by the Russian secret services. Having knowledge of the system, I know that the order about such a killing of a citizen of another country on its own territory, especially if it is something to do with Great Britain, could only have been given by one person. That person is the President of the Russian Federation, Vladimir Putin." A more than 300-page report by Sir Robert Owen, chairman of the Litvinenko Inquiry, concluded that Litvinenko was given a fatal dose of polonium during his meeting with Lugovoy and Kovtun, who were identified as prime suspects. Russia has refused to extradite either of the two men. On March 9, 2015, just after the UK's Litvinenko Inquiry had put together substantial evidence implicating Lugovoy in the murder, President Putin granted Lugovoy a medal for services to the motherland. According to Ben Emerson, the Queen's counsel for Litvinenko's widow, Marina, the timing of Putin's decision was no coincidence. It is clearly both a provocation from President Putin and the clearest possible message he identifies himself with Mr. Lugovoy. In his report, Sir Robert concluded, "The FSB operation to kill Litvinenko was probably approved by then-FSB Chief Nikolai Mr. Patrushev and also by President Putin." In a reference to the pedophilia charges, Sir Robert added, "It hardly needs saying that the allegations made by Mr. Litvinenko against President Putin in this article were of the most serious nature. Could they have had any connection with his death?" But the report also noted that Litvinenko's testimony before the Mitrokhin Commission and the intelligence he furnished Mario Scaramella, the Mitrokhin Commission attorney, was particularly sensitive in describing Mogilevich as someone in a good relationship with President Putin, a relationship that included Mogilevich's sale of weapons to Al-Qaeda and acting as the FSB's long-standing agent. In addition, there was the fact that Litvinenko had played a role in the transcription and publicizing of the so-called Kuchma tapes, a.k.a. the Melnichenko tapes, including making a statement before the Mitrokhin Commission that Mogilevich is in a very close relationship with Russian President Putin. At the present, Putin is Mogilevich's krisha, protection in criminal jargon. This is Putin who protects Mogilevich. That provocative revelation could also have been a motive for murder. In the end, many questions remain unanswered, but a few things are certain. On November 23, 2006, Litvinenko died of polonium-210 poisoning. Anna Politkovskaya had been dead for 2 months, and Putin's Russia had become a mafia state in which compliant loyalists became billionaires and telling the truth could get you killed. Chapter 16. Blood Money. Even though Litvinenko was dead, the issues he had been investigating were more alive than ever. That was especially true in Ukraine, where Prime Minister Viktor Yanukovych, a Putin partisan, advanced to the runoff election for president in 2004 amidst widespread allegations of fraud. Yanukovych's dubious tactics triggered the Orange Revolution of 2004 and 2005, and a Ukrainian Supreme Court ruling that nullified his victory. From the Kremlin's point of view, Yanukovych's reversal created a serious problem. He had been a highly reliable pawn for Putin. The Firtash-Mogilevich money pipeline that siphoned off billions from Ukraine's energy trade was a paradigm of how Putin was able to transform control over Russia's natural resources into political power. And to keep this arrangement in place, Putin needed a reliable surrogate in charge in Ukraine. It began with Gazprom, Russia's largely state-owned energy giant, selling enormous amounts of natural gas to Rosukrenergo, RUE, Mogilevich's and Firtash's intermediary, at bargain basement prices, thereby putting RUE in a position to resell it to European nations at a huge markup. Firtash became a billionaire. Putin allegedly took a sizable share as well. The oligarchs in turn then funded Yanukovych's pro-Russian Party of Regions to keep Ukraine securely in Putin's camp and to make sure these highly profitable deals remained in place. In a diplomatic cable, then U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, John Herbst, referred to the Party of Regions as a haven for Donetsk-based mobsters and oligarchs. All of which was ideal, except for one thing. Yanukovych was a lousy candidate, and if he was to remain the leader of the Party of Regions, he desperately needed a makeover to wipe out the image he had as a thuggish Kremlin stooge. His resume was not much help. In his youth, Yanukovych had been twice convicted of assault. In 2004, his rival Viktor Yushchenko barely survived an assassination attempt by dioxin poisoning during the campaign and blamed the poisoning on unnamed government officials who feared he would beat Yanukovych. Even if Yanukovych's camp had nothing to do with the dioxin, there were widespread allegations of massive vote rigging, which were echoed by Secretary of State Colin Powell, who cited credible reports of fraud and abuse. In the end, there was enough evidence that the Supreme Court of Ukraine annulled the election after Yanukovych was initially declared the winner. In the revote, Yushchenko won. When it came to oligarchs such as Dmitry Firtash and aluminum tycoon Oleg Deripaska, Yanukovych had known how to be wonderfully compliant, but now that wasn't enough. With a fortune of $12 billion, he had become a symbol of unbridled greed that was embodied by Mezhikhura, his insanely extravagant estate, which was known as Ukraine's Versailles, with its private zoo with kangaroos and a herd of ostrich, a yacht club, a galleon in its pond, marble floors, $100,000 chandeliers, a collection of 70 rare cars, a helicopter pad, and more. So, Yanukovych was damaged goods. The Party of Regions needed a new face, or a dramatic makeover. Enter Paul Manafort, formerly of the GOP consulting firm Black, Manafort, Stone & Kelly, and now with his new firm, Davis, Manafort & Friedman. Brilliantly skewered in a memorable 1992 Spy magazine piece by Art Levine, Paul Manafort and Roger Stone's firm, in all its various incarnations over the years, came to occupy a hallowed place in the dark, amoral domain of Washington lobbying. Name a corrupt despot, and Black Manafort will name the account. Ferdinand Marcos, $900,000 a year. The now-deposed Somalian dictatorship, $450,000. The drug-linked Bahamian government, $800,000, Spy reported, before going on to rate various firms in terms of how dodgy their clients were. Black, Manafort, Stone, and Kelly won out as the sleaziest of them all. Boyhood friends who learned their craft at the feet of Richard Nixon and Roy Cohn, Manafort and Stone had put together the hottest lobbying shop in Washington. Their firm had played a vital role in the 1980 election of Ronald Reagan. Their first client after Reagan's election had been Donald Trump, who retained them to help with federal issues such as getting permits to dredge the channel to the Atlantic City Marina to make room for Trump's yacht, the Trump Princess. Of the two men, Stone was the showboat, buff from the gym, sporting bleached blonde hair, the proud owner of 5 Jaguars, 100 silver wedding ties, and countless designer suits, and the subject of fashion stories in Penthouse and GQ, such a dandy that he even coined aphorisms, Stone's rules, about cufflinks. Large hubcap types are for mafia dons from Jersey and Las Vegas lounge singers. Cufflinks should be small, understated, and tasteful. A self-proclaimed libertine, Stone displayed a photo in his Miami office of himself clad only in a banana hammock, standing poolside next to porn star Nina Hartley. If the photo had shown him from behind, you'd have seen the face of Richard Nixon tattooed on his back. All of which made him catnip to reporters, who couldn't resist the bravado of a spinmeister who walked down the aisle of press buses and called out, "I'm here. Who needs to be spun?" Next to Stone, Manafort was relatively understated, although over time he cultivated a more lavish globe-trotting lifestyle in keeping with the oligarchs he worked for. Putting on his long overcoat with a grand sweeping gesture, he cut such a swashbuckling figure that friends reportedly dubbed him the Count of Monte Cristo. But in general, he played his cards close to his vest, befitting a protege of George H.W. Bush's consigliere, James Baker. Baker was all smoothness and charm, the velvet hammer, always proper, but a man no one wanted to cross. From Baker, Manafort learned the art of ostentatious humility, writes Franklin Foer in The Atlantic, how to use the knife to butter up and then stab in the back. Together, Manafort and Stone rewrote the rulebook on lobbying, bundling political consulting, public relations, and other services into an operation that Time magazine called the ultimate supermarket of influence peddling. Before long, they went global and took an almost perverse and giddy pride in representing the most brutal tyrants on the planet, including Iraq's Saddam Hussein, Nicolae Ceausescu of Romania, Zairean dictator Mobutu Sese Seko, and regimes that enslaved children and murdered priests. Black, Manafort, Stone, and Kelly lined up most of the dictators of the world we could find, Stone crowed. The firm's propensity to represent dictators, rulers from the Dominican Republic, Nigeria, Kenya, Equatorial Guinea, and Somalia were also clients, was such that the Center for Public Integrity included them in a report titled The Torturer's Lobby. So on some level, working for Yanukovych in Ukraine was more of the same for Manafort. On the other hand, Ukraine was a real geopolitical tinderbox. At a time when the EU and NATO were inching ever closer to Russia's borders, Putin was determined that Ukraine not fall into the West's sphere of influence. Manafort's work in Ukraine began in late 2004 when he was hired as a general consultant to the Party of Regions to transform Yanukovych's image from that of the arch-villain of the Orange Revolution and a pawn of Putin to that of a pro-West reformer who was one of Ukraine's most popular politicians. And so, Manafort operatives moved into a small office for 6 to 8 people on the first floor of 4 Sofievskaya Street in Kiev. Ukrainska Pravda described the office as mysterious and noted that the windows were curtained all day long. When journalists approached, they were politely told to leave and not come back. Over the next decade, Manafort made at least 138 trips to Ukraine in a spectacularly lucrative relationship that also took him into the shadowy world of flight capital, offshore shell companies, banks in Cyprus, and Russian agents. Far more than a mere political consultant, Manafort had the kind of power in Ukraine that American intelligence operatives and oil executives had brandished back in the Cold War era, when covert operations staged coups in Guatemala or Iran. Manafort, however, had found a way to undertake his operations without being in any way attached to the United States government, indeed often working against America's stated policies, all while making tens of millions of dollars, much of which, according to an indictment that was later filed, went into foreign tax havens and then into real estate, antique rugs, expensive cars, and other instruments used to avoid taxes. His deputy, Rick Gates, who played a key role in Manafort's Ukraine operation, explained to a group of Washington lobbyists, "Paul has a whole separate shadow government structure. In every ministry, he has a guy." At the time, Russian intelligence agents had penetrated the highest levels of power in various institutions throughout Ukraine, and Manafort's operation was no exception. His most trusted protege, Konstantin Kilimnik, who was affectionately known as KK, was a case in point. Also called Manafort's Manafort, because he was his boss's right hand, Kilimnik, though just over 5 feet tall next to the 6-foot-plus Manafort, aped his employer in many ways, The Atlantic reported, driving the same BMW and wearing similar designer suits. But what was most interesting about Kilimnik was that the man Paul Manafort so heavily relied on in Ukraine was a foot soldier for Russian intelligence. Kilimnik told the New York Times he had no ties to Russian intelligence, but in fact he had studied at the Military Institute of the Ministry of Defense in Moscow, which trains interpreters for the Russian Military Intelligence Agency, formerly known as the GRU, and now called the Main Directorate. Moreover, according to Phil Griffin, a longtime political consultant with Manafort, who hired Kilimnik in the early 2000s to work at the International Republican Institute in Moscow, he was completely upfront about his past work with Russian military intelligence. It was no big deal. Given the language barrier, Kilimnik became crucial. Because Paul doesn't speak Russian or Ukrainian, he always had to have someone like that with him in meetings, said one operative who worked with Manafort. So KK was with him all the time. He was very close to Paul and very trusted. Assisting Manafort covered a lot of ground. Manafort and his team launched a potent disinformation campaign to discredit Yanukovych's rivals, using covert operations that could have been pulled straight out of the KGB playbook. According to The Guardian, Manafort worked with former Wall Street Journal and Financial Times reporter Alan Friedman to propose an ambitious strategy to discredit rival Yulia Tymoshenko all over the world. They set about smearing Ukrainian opponents of Yanukovych by rewriting their Wikipedia entries. They set up a phony think tank in Vienna called the Center for the Study of Former Soviet Socialist Republics, which proceeded to disseminate articles supporting Yanukovych. When then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton publicly supported Yulia Tymoshenko, Manafort's team allied with Breitbart, the right-wing news site, to attack Hillary for creating a neo-Nazi Frankenstein. Thanks to his work with Yanukovych, Manafort was soon fully conversant with a network of oligarchs, including aluminum billionaire Oleg Deripaska, coal and steel tycoon Rinat Akhmetov, and natural gas magnate Dmitry Firtash. Manafort was introduced by Yanukovych's people to Firtash, Deripaska, and others, and it opened up a whole new world for him, said Kenneth McCallion. Now, the money began to roll in. In late 2004, Deripaska dispatched Manafort to the eastern Ukraine city of Donetsk, the Wall Street Journal reported, where he met Rinat Akhmetov. A billionaire financier behind the Party of Regions, Akhmetov agreed to pay Manafort's firm roughly $12 million to provide corporate strategy and branding assistance for his holding company, System Capital Management. Less than a year later, in 2005, according to the Associated Press, Manafort began a secret deal with Deripaska whereby Manafort's firm was paid $10 million per year to influence politics, business dealings, and media coverage inside the U.S., Europe, and the former Soviet republics in a way that would benefit Vladimir Putin's government. Deripaska was among the 2 to 3 oligarchs Putin turns to on a regular basis, according to a diplomatic cable published by WikiLeaks. So Manafort clearly knew whose interests were being served. "We are now of the belief that this model can greatly benefit the Putin government," Manafort wrote in the proposal. He added that his firm would be offering a great service that can refocus, both internally and externally, the policies of the Putin government. Lobbyists serving the interests of foreign governments are required to register with the Justice Department under the Foreign Agents Registration Act. However, Manafort did not bother to register until June 2017. In summer 2005, Manafort went to Moscow before Ukraine's parliamentary elections and met with Yanukovych, Akhmetov, and other influential Ukrainians tied to the Party of Regions. At times, Yanukovych made noises about cooperating with the U.S. But Ambassador John Herbst told the Daily Beast that such sentiments stopped as soon as they infringed upon Yanukovych's core interests in Ukraine, which were related, among other things, to ensuring his friends got their share of the national pie, and things that might have ticked off the Kremlin. Articulating pro-West sentiments was terrifically popular with voters, especially in the western half of the country during electoral campaigns. But Yanukovych's heart and wallet were in Moscow. He was out for the good of himself, his group, and also his country, starting with himself and his group, said Herbst. And for that, having a good relationship with the U.S. was a counter to being overly dependent on the Kremlin. As for Manafort, Herbst noted that the Party of Regions, long a haven for Donetsk-based mobsters and oligarchs, had taken on Manafort for an extreme makeover to transform its image into that of a democratic political force. Meanwhile, Manafort began to live an outrageously extravagant lifestyle commensurate with his huge income. He bought a brownstone in New York and a home in Arlington, Virginia. He got 3 Range Rovers and a Mercedes-Benz and paid for expensive improvements at his homes in the Hamptons and Palm Beach, Florida. But he brought in so much money from Ukraine that in order to hide it from U.S. authorities, he allegedly laundered it through scores of United States and foreign corporations, partnerships, and bank accounts, and allegedly filed false income tax returns, failed to file foreign bank reports, and engaged in bank fraud conspiracy. In 2017 and 2018, Manafort and Gates were indicted on a total of 44 counts of money laundering, bank fraud, and tax charges. In all, Manafort is said to have deposited $75 million in offshore accounts. He also allegedly laundered more than $30 million in income by purchasing property, goods, and services, such as valuable antique rugs, automobiles, real estate, landscaping, and home improvements for his house in the Hamptons, and hiding his income from the U.S. Treasury. Richard Gates is said to have transferred more than $3 million from the offshore accounts to other accounts he controlled. Among the offshore companies Manafort used to wire millions of dollars to the United States was a shell company called Lusical Consultants Limited. It was held in the name of Ukrainian businessman and legislator Ivan Fursin, who was a senior figure in the Mogilevich criminal organization, Taras Kuzio, a fellow at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies Center for Transatlantic Relations, told the Daily Beast. Among many other transactions with Lusical, Manafort allegedly transferred more than $1.3 million to a home improvement company in the Hamptons. In the meantime, for candidate Yanukovych, the makeover had begun. Manafort and Yanukovych became friends. They played tennis together at Mezhuhura. Manafort had the good sense to let Yanukovych win. As reported by The Atlantic, they swam nude together outside the banya, sauna. Manafort was given to wearing fine Italian suits. He got Yanukovych to do the same. Manafort combed his hair back, ditto for Yanukovych. Manafort taught him how to make small talk and how to wave to a crowd. Manafort taught Yanukovych how to speak, how to become a Western type of candidate, a media star, said Ken McCallion. Manafort introduced polling techniques, micro-targeting, and voter turnout practices that were standard operating procedure in the U.S. He even taught Yanukovych to steal lines from American politicians. "I understand your dreams," Yanukovych told supporters at a rally, before he borrowed an oldie but goodie from Bill Clinton's repertoire. "I feel your pain, and I share in your desire to make Ukraine a land of opportunity." In 2006, Yanukovych's Party of Regions did far better than anyone expected in the parliamentary elections, resulting in Yanukovych's becoming prime minister. That put Manafort in a position to ask for and get more and more money. Every time he submitted extravagant bills, Yanukovych simply asked other oligarchs to chip in a million or so. There was no end in sight. One major source of the funds was Dmitry Firtash, whose billions, Reuters reported, grew out of remarkable sweetheart deals brokered by associates of Russian leader Vladimir Putin at immense cost to Russian taxpayers. His money, of course, came from the billions of dollars skimmed off the top of the energy trade, principally Turkmen and Russian natural gas, in Ukraine by Rosukrenergo at bargain basement prices and resold at much higher Western market prices. In March 2008, U.S. Ambassador to Russia William Burns tried to get to the bottom of what RUE really was by meeting with a representative of the company, who, he cabled, seemed like a man who had received instructions to reveal nothing and who was very comfortable in that role. Our meeting with him helped confirm that RUE has little interest in revealing its inner workings. On paper, RUE was half-owned by Gazprom and half by Firtash and Ivan Fursin. But as Yulia Tymoshenko, the braided leader of the pro-West Orange Revolution, who became prime minister of Ukraine in 2005, alleged, they were just fronts for a powerful and familiar name in organized crime. "When I was the prime minister," she said, "we provided the president of Ukraine with documented proof that some powerful criminal structures are behind the Rosukrenergo company. I can only say, as a politician, we have no doubts whatsoever that the man named Mogilevich is behind the whole operation called Rosukrenergo." Nevertheless, RUE continued to rake in the dough. Between 2010 and 2014 alone, According to Russian customs documents detailing the trade, Gazprom sold more than 20 billion cubic meters of gas at prices so low that Firtash and possibly Mogilevich made more than $3 billion. In addition, bankers close to Putin gave Firtash up to $11 billion in credit, which positioned Firtash to become a dominant player in Ukraine's chemical and fertilizer industry and a major